I'm Vermont Edition co-host Bob Kinzel. Just wanted to let you know that this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Yesterday, Attorney General Jeff Sessions announced that the Trump administration plans to revoke President Obama's executive order giving temporary legal reprieve to people in the United States who were brought here illegally as children. They've had to register with the government, and in exchange, they've been allowed to get driver's licenses, work legally, and have some of the privileges afforded to people in the country with legal status. This new announcement has implications for people around the country, including some in Vermont. VPR's New England News Collaborative reporter Kathleen Masterson has been working with the team of reporters across our region to better understand what the president's decision means here. And she joins us now. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, Jane.
So can you explain just a couple of the particulars of DACA, how it works?
Sure. Well, as you said, it applies to children who came to the U.S. who were brought here illegally by their parents. And those applicable are any kids who came under 16. They can apply for this two-year permit that allows them to work. They have to be working toward a high school diploma or GED or already have one. And then they can get a work permit for 2 years, driver's license in most states. And they also have to have no criminal record. But it was sort of a temporary pathway that could be renewed every 2 years.
But not a pathway to citizenship.
Correct.
So this announcement from yesterday, it's not immediate. It's not an immediate revocation of the DACA program. And there's some question about whether or not Congress will be able to pass something, will even take something up in the intervening months to take it out of the administration's hands. The announcement was that there's 6 months. So what in the intervening 6 months now are people thinking will be the immediate impact for people who are actually affected by this?
Right. And it kind of comes down to when is your renewal date? An immigration attorney who is familiar with the memo, who read the memo, explained it to me that basically if you have an expiration date after March 5th, so it's about 6 months from now in 2018, then you will not be allowed to reapply. So basically you can stay through your current renewal. So maybe you have 2 more years, maybe you have 7 more months, 6 months in 1 day, and then you can stay through that period. And then you really are out of luck if Congress doesn't do anything. The way things currently stand is DACA is over. Those people don't have a pathway. For those whose renewal expires before March 5th, and they're very strict about this, this attorney had a client who was expired March 8th, and it is really troubling to her, then they can apply for renewal, but that'll be a case-by-case basis. And given this administration's stance toward DACA, it's unclear what would happen to those people. But for a lot of people, as soon as their current DACA status expires, that's it for them now.
So if your current status expires in the next 2 months, the understanding as it is so far is that you can reapply, you can get another 2-year extension under DACA, and that even though after 6 months as it currently stands, that program will be revoked, you'd be able to stay out for the length of that official status that you have, and then you'd have to leave or be subject to deportation.
Right, right. Okay. And so, you know, there's not necessarily going to be a wave of deportations, but it does mean that if anyone is encountered, if you're doing a normal driving to work, you're an illegal alien.
Who are the people in Vermont and in New England who are subject to DACA?
Yeah, well, we think we have about 40 in Vermont. There are about 42 people who applied with a Vermont address. Presumably includes some students. Universities haven't released any numbers here in Vermont. And there are about 15,000 in New England. And one thing important to consider is that, you know, many of them came to this country at a young age. English may well be their first language. Some are bilingual. But the reality is a lot of these kids who basically grew up American.
42 people that we know of with Vermont addresses, low number for Vermont compared to other states then.
Right. Yeah. Connecticut and Massachusetts have the bulk of the New England 15,000. But that's just where they applied. So it is possible there are additional Vermont students. But it's still, compared to the rest of New England, it's a lower number.
And often these people are referred to as dreamers. This was President Obama's name for them. It's sort of taken on this official status. And you actually talked to one dreamer about what her reaction is.
Yeah, I spoke with Marta Herrera Correa. She's 27 now. She came to the U.S. when she was 15 in 2005. She actually was in New York State, attended high school, also was working a night shift, 1 a.m. to 9 a.m. at a factory. Luckily, she was able to get her GED, which when the program started in 2012 made her eligible. So she has been a DACA recipient since then. She said that allowed her to get a better job, actually take legal vacations. She was able to drive to work, which is pretty big for someone who's sort of previously living in fear of deportation. And I asked her, you know, what would this mean if you were to be deported back to Mexico?
Sería muy diferente porque como casi tengo la mitad de mi vida aquí, pues tengo mi vida como mi vida hecha aquí y pues tengo mi familia, tengo amigos y sería difícil porque en mi país como muchos años que yo salí de allá.
It would be really difficult. I've been here almost half my life. I've made my home here. I've made my life here. This is the country I know. Going to Mexico would be a really difficult transition here.
And Kathleen, that gentleman's voice that you heard, she was joined by someone from Migrant Justice, an activism group here for issues of immigration, and he was doing some interpreting for you.
Exactly right, he did. And she's also married to another activist with Migrant Justice, just to be clear, so that's a potential pathway for her. Most Dreamers don't have that option at all.
Kathleen, Vermont's congressional delegation was swift to come out in opposition to this announcement. What else is happening around New England in reaction?
Sure. Well, already in the greater Boston area, there have been hundreds of people showing up at protests. My colleague in Connecticut reported a similar, slightly lower turnout at a university there. So universities and crowds have been pretty quick to react. Also, the Attorney General of Massachusetts has said that she may join other states' attorneys general in filing a lawsuit. There's other rumors of that. It's unclear exactly what their argument would be yet.
VPR's Kathleen Masterson. She's reporting on DACA and immigration issues for the station and for the New England News Collaborative. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Jane.
And now we turn to Vermont's Lieutenant Governor, David Zuckerman. Nice to have you with us, David Zuckerman.
Thank you, Jane.
Let's start by getting your reaction to Jeff Sessions' announcement yesterday and the Trump administration's decision to revoke President Obama's executive order on the Dreamers, DACA.
Well, certainly I'm very disappointed. We've seen from this administration just a nonstop barrage attack on people of color, on people of various religious faiths. He's continued this administration to stand behind a lot of hate group activity by not straightforwardly denouncing it. Former Senator Sessions, Attorney General, has historically been someone who's been on a very different side of these issues than where I believe most Vermonters are, where I am. And certainly I hope and I support Peter Welsh's comments that in Congress they can be productive, they can move something forward. I don't have a tremendous amount of faith relative to that hope, given the scenario in Congress right now. They really can't organize themselves out of a box. The Republicans have been clamoring for control for years and years as an opposition party, and it's turned out they really don't have ideas, they don't have plans, and they have no cohesion. And our country needs leadership and cohesion to move forward in these challenging times, whether it's the international scenarios with North Korea, but also around our own domestic issues, our economy, raising the debt ceiling, building our infrastructure, creating jobs. And they are focusing on these issues that are not, frankly, front and center for most Americans in terms of impacting people on a day-to-day basis, except for the fact that these 800,000 people often, as Kathleen was just saying, they work the night shift. They're the ones that every day when you show up to work, the workplace is clean. They're the ones who are getting nursing degrees and are caring for our infirm individuals at nursing homes and in hospitals. These folks are productive members of our society, just like anyone else. They're paying taxes. They're contributing to our economy. Some of them are buying homes. I got a statistic the other day from the CVOEO website that in Chittenden County alone, new Americans every year contribute about $712 million to the GDP in Chittenden County.
And that's CVOEO is the Champlain Valley Office of Economic Opportunity.
Yes, sorry about that. And folks can go to their website to learn more. The reality is these folks are hardworking individuals contributing in our society, and they're not the folks that we need to be targeting with our governmental actions.
But are you, like most other Americans, despite your position in Vermont state government, basically just an observer of what happens with the federal government?
Unfortunately, at this point, yes. You know, we have a great federal delegation with Senators Leahy and Sanders and Congressman Welsh, and they're doing, I'm sure, everything they can to move positive legislation forward. I plan to talk with T.J. Donovan, our own attorney general, to find out whether or not we can join. I think New York and maybe California are already looking at suing or maybe already suing to get this action by the president thwarted, and what actions TJ would take on those. TJ is an independent elected officer in Vermont as well, so it's his call, but I'd like to find out more about what he's planning and urge him to stay engaged the way he has in some other issues.
And again, immigration issues are basically in federal jurisdiction. So from a perspective of a Vermonter, a Vermont politician, a Vermont farmer, are there things that you are agitating for or advocating for on the immigration subject, even if you don't actually have the power or the ability to change them?
Well, certainly being a elected official in the country, one of 100 governors and lieutenant governors, I've added my name to some letters nationally around immigration issues in general, because there's such a range of them right now. Also, you know, I want to commend Governor Scott earlier this year when the travel ban, as it was called, was put in by the president. Governor Scott stepped up and pulled together a number of us, and we passed legislation quite quickly to make sure that our state and local law enforcement would be focused on local safety issues and not be diverted in terms of their time and attention away from local safety issues. You know, this brings in similar scenarios with, for instance, Sheriff Arpaio, who the president just completely out of the blue pardoned without even going through any of the normal processes of review. And there's a lot of evidence that while Arpaio was spending time on immigration issues, there were a lot of sex crime issues and violent crime issues in his own area that went unprosecuted and uninvestigated. Our law enforcement should be focusing on the safety and security of Vermonters. And so I commend the governor and his work to say that's what we're going to focus our law enforcement on. We're doing what we can within the confines of, as you point out, what we have authority over in the state relative to federal jurisdiction.
I'm talking with Lieutenant Governor David Zuckerman. We've been talking a little bit about immigration issues in light of the announcement by Jeff Sessions yesterday that the Trump administration would like to eliminate the DACA program, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. Let's talk a little bit about marijuana, because that is an area that you have been vocal in your support of, the legalization of recreational marijuana. It did not pass this session.
Well, it did pass.
It did pass. There is no legal marijuana. Right. So what are you doing now in your role as lieutenant governor to continue or move forward that issue? Because it seems like it just, you know, it comes up every year.
Well, it's interesting because a number of people who are opposed have said to me, well, it's inevitable. I know that, you know, when I talk to them and I say, well, then do we want to do it right? Get it implemented, be at the, frankly, at the front wave so that we not only address the issues of the underground scenario, we get the revenue to put drug recognition experts on the roads, and we can take early advantage of some of the tourism revenue that we would also build in the state, or do we want to wait? And that's a big discussion. That's what's going on around the state. At this point, I think the majority of Vermonters are ready to move forward from what I've heard, from polling that I've seen. When you look at the sky is falling scenarios that are talked about in Colorado, most of them are, frankly, not true or anomalies in minor statistic or ways, but we can learn from those. For instance, the edibles. They used to make edibles that were much too potent and not individual serving amounts. So either no edibles, as Governor Shumlin had talked about, or single-serving packaging. So the lessons are there to be learned. And now if we wait, we're simply going to have the problems that are supposedly out there with respect to neighboring Massachusetts and nearby neighboring Maine, certainly to the Northeast Kingdom, without any of the benefit. So why not develop the bill as we had planned with the bill that passed this spring, which would allow for small home possession and home production, and a study to look at how do we methodically and properly create a tax and regulate system. We can still move forward with that discussion. I think the governor's talked about a commission. He hasn't appointed very many people yet. I've heard about a few people that may be appointed, and I'd like to help them with information and have them help all of us understand what that commission's going to do. But I do think the legislature has the intention, at least in the Senate, of moving forward with something in January to continue the ball rolling. You know, the Joint Fiscal Office had a report that said it would be about $368 million of economic activity for the state. That's significant. And that's significant in light of the federal cuts that are going to be coming in terms of the rural economy. You know, if we had 100 or 500 small growth facilities, each with 2 to 5 employees, making $40,000 to $60,000 a year spread throughout the state, you're talking about 1,000 to 1,500 jobs. You know, some people say, let's attract one big business with huge tax breaks and give away all of our hard-earned tax dollars to bring one business or industry that may 5 years later up and move because of the global economy, or we could produce a couple hundred small, diverse businesses throughout the rural economy and support our rural communities and support our state economy, which I think fits in the, quote, affordability agenda of the governor, who unfortunately did veto that legislation.
So you're in favor of creating a retail structure that includes small businesses, not one where it's just personal growing and sort of personal possession?
Well, absolutely. I think you get sort of less than half the loaf if you do personal possession and personal grow, and yet more of the potential problems without any of the state revenue to address those issues. I think it's also really important in this discussion. Some people think, well, if we do this, all of a sudden, all these people will be using cannabis. People have to recognize or take the wool off of their eyes and know that thousands and thousands of Vermonts use cannabis today. They get it from a drug dealer, some of whom are, you know, Vermonters who have a clean product and they've got a good relationship. Other, it's imported, and you never know whether it's laced with another drug. They're not checking IDs for age, whereas a regulated system, you would be checked for IDs just as when you go into a bar to get alcohol. And a regulated system would also allow you to know the strength of what you have. Right now, you don't know if you buy something, whether it's really strong or weaker. And unlike alcohol, where you know how much alcohol is in a beer, you know how much alcohol is in a glass of wine, and you know how much alcohol is in a shot of whiskey, if that's what you happen to drink. You don't have any of that in today's system, which exists. So this is about bringing it above board and regulating it and managing it much better.
Are you among those Vermonters who is a consumer of cannabis?
I have not in a long time. I did visit Washington State a few years ago, and it was legal. And so I did try it with a friend. But it's been years other than that.
So do you have a personal interest in having legalization, or do you see this more as a statewide issue?
Well, I would say it's evolved over time. I've been supporting this for 20 years. And certainly back when I was in college first running for office, I supported it because both I believed in it and I consumed quite a bit of it. But since then, I've started a business. I've got a family. I'm lieutenant governor. I was a senator. Frankly, I'm just really too busy. I'm not exactly a teetotaler.
Come on.
No, I'm not a teetotaler, but I even don't go out and drink very much. I'm up at 4 or 5 every morning. It's hard to participate in any of those activities when you're getting up that early and trying to crank out a business.
Let's go to Kevin, who's calling in from Burlington. Hi, Kevin. Go right ahead.
Hi. First off, just appreciate the honesty from you on as being a user in the past. But one of the questions I had for you was, what would you be doing legislatively to protect smaller businesses if this were to go legal? I see a lot of this bigger corporate move-in, and I worry about that for Vermont.
Sure, that's a great question. The legislation actually that I'd like to see ideally would have unlimited small grower licenses, so 500 or 1,000 square feet. And certainly a few people can make a living and employ a couple other people on that scale production facility. And then a limited number of 5,000 or 10,000 square feet, which sounds like a lot of space, and certainly you can produce a fair amount, but not any kind of amount to then dominate the marketplace. When you look at Alaska or you look at Colorado, Colorado actually had enough production, but Alaska ran out. And if we only had 500 square foot facilities, we actually would probably not have enough cannabis for what is currently being consumed in Vermont, much less what would be consumed if we had it legal and regulated, much like our alcohol industry. We attract people to come to Vermont for weekends and even week-long vacations to visit our incredible microbrew industry. I think Vermonters from right to left are generally excited about that industry, excited about the jobs that are in it, excited about the people that come and stay in bed and breakfasts, the folks that might come to ski in Vermont relative to some other state because at the slopes or at the restaurants and bars in the evening, they've got this range of quality beer. The same opportunity exists. And we have so many people within that one-day drive to come and visit in Vermont and be those tourists that we love for foliage, we love for the ski industry, we love for summer recreation. You know, unlike Colorado, Colorado has nobody around it. They are the populated state in that area. And yet people are flying from all over the country and all over the world to go there. We would have that opportunity with people commuting here.
One of the differences, though, between the craft brewing industry and what you're proposing for cannabis is you'd have this cap or this limit on production. And, you know, we've seen brewers in Vermont, cider makers in Vermont, who have been able to recognize incredible growth because of their popularity. I mean, you just look in Middlebury at Woodchuck Cider, which is now owned by a large corporation, but it also has had this huge expansion.
It's a beautiful facility.
It's a beautiful facility, but that wouldn't be possible under a very limited or capped system for cannabis. So what would be the incentive for growers who want to say, I want to make this a business and then expand when I'm popular?
Well, I think there's a couple things. With unlimited small licenses, folks can get into the business and they can make a good living at that scale. The second part was, at least in legislation earlier, and we've had various bits, so I can't remember which bill it was, there was a commission to look at whether or not to allow them to expand, to allow there to be even more or more of those larger. So maybe someone who started at 500 could then get a 1,000 or 5,000 square foot license. So it would be an ongoing discussion. I don't think it has to be a create the law and never change it scenario.
But it would be a way to prevent a rush.
It would be a way to prevent a rush, prevent Anheuser-Busch from taking over, or Monsanto, who frankly is actually already working to own patents on various cannabis seeds. You know, it's really, there is no doubt that people with money are looking at this industry and want to take it over. But if we limit those larger scale scenarios, then we can actually have a much better set of control that those businesses are at least operated locally, if not owned locally, and there isn't one company owning them all and then setting the price, setting the opportunity of different varieties, and so forth.
Let's go to Ken calling in from Salisbury. Hi, Ken. Go right ahead.
Yes, hi. Thanks for the topic. I'm looking for some advice from the Lieutenant Governor. I saw you in Middlebury the other day, and on Labor Day and hearing you today, I'm most impressed with your approach. I'm a real strong and well-read, proud liberal my whole life, but I'm very concerned about liberalism right now. I want to be a pragmatic liberal who gets things done, and that's what I'm most impressed about, the way you are approaching your job as Lieutenant Governor. I'm not content to sit on Facebook and say clever things or be self-satisfied and know I'm right, but I think liberalism is hardening, especially here in Vermont. We are, I think, as bad as conservatives with our inability to compromise, our inability to hold our nose sometimes and go along with things, except half a loaf when that's all we can get. So I'm looking for some advice from you on how you're able to be a pragmatic, functional, compromising liberal who goes to the middle when necessary.
Wow. Well, thank you, Ken. I appreciate it. And that was a great rally on Labor Day with Bernie down there. He made four stops throughout the day. That guy is an energizer bunny like nobody's business. But it was a very empowering audience there as well. It was a pleasure to speak to it, talking about workers' rights and the struggles, and that really all of us have somewhere in our history a struggle that our family has gone through as an immigrant at one time, as a person of color, as a person of a particular faith that was persecuted. And, you know, I think that's one of the things that's really important that we reflect on right now is when we look at whether it's a one-time event, like just the horrors of Hurricane Harvey and Hurricane Irma that's coming, and how we need to be reaching out to people, regardless of any kind of differences that we have, to help and to lend a helping hand, to lend or give money if we can, making sure we sometimes either reflect on our own past or we find a way to put ourselves into someone else's shoes and look at the world from their eyes and their lens. And if you can do that and you can sit and reflect on that, then you often are more capable of finding common ground with them. They may see the world in a different way. They may see a particular instance in a different way. But if you can find that common humanity and that common sense of we're all in this together, then you can find ways to compromise and recognize that if they give some and you or me or anybody else gives some, then we're moving forward. You know, standing face to face yelling at each other isn't moving forward at all. In fact, most people dig their heels in because they feel like the other person is then trying to push them backwards. And I just think it's a much better method to sit down with someone, talk with them, learn more about who they are, what their position is, and then take hands and start walking together. It might not be in the exact direction you want to go, but you're still moving forward. And that's just kind of the philosophy I take with a lot of things. I'm certainly very, you know, dogmatic and very strong-willed in the positions that I have, and I will fight and argue for them. But if you're not willing to listen while you're fighting for something, then I agree with you. You can be just as bad from the right or the left. The other thing is to really make sure to check facts and be willing to admit if you've stated a fact that it turns out to be incorrect, that it was incorrect. But really, we all have to check our facts. I think what you mentioned, Facebook, there's a lot of social media. There's a lot of, unfortunately, you know, ill-willed people out there putting out, quote, facts that are just not correct. I would argue that that's happening more from the right these days. I think there's some pretty solid statistics showing that around social media in particular, the Breitbart News and those avenues and some of the right-wing hate groups, what they're putting out. But on occasion, the rhetoric from the left can be inaccurate as well. And we all have to take ownership for when we're not as accurate with our information.
When it comes to politics, you're actually headed out of state at the end of this week. You're headed to California, and part of what you'll be doing there, you're going to be speaking, giving a keynote address at a Soil Not Oil conference, but
Correct.
You're also going to be advocating for and supporting progressive candidates and causes. Why go to California to do that?
Well, they invited me to, frankly, and it's an opportunity to build bridges, and I would go other places as well if people want, and I won't otherwise because I've got plenty to do here. But they reached out to me as one of the leading progressive elected people in the country, whether Democrat, progressive, that part not mattering as much, but the progressive policies, and asked me to come both with my farming heritage because it's a soil, not oil discussion in Richmond, California, where there's a huge oil refinery scenario and a lot of immigrant and low-income workers have been exploited over decades, and there's a lot of environmental pollution. So it fits with a lot of the types of issues that I've worked on over the years. And they invited me to speak both to those issues and also how has, you know, Bernie come to power in Vermont, which started long before I was involved in politics, but he inspired me in 1992. And how did someone like myself engage first at the state representative level and work my way up? There's a group in Richmond of city councilors and former mayor who's now running for lieutenant governor who have formed a coalition similar to what the Progressive Coalition was a couple decades ago. So I think there's just a sisterhood and a brotherhood there with respect to challenging establishment politics, but doing it in an effective grassroots, build it from the bottom up way. You know, there are calls for people like Bernie to run as an independent or a green for president. And I think to the prior caller in terms of pragmatism, there's just an economic reality. There's a political reality to working both within the system and challenging the system at the same time. And I know that some people get frustrated by what I've done, where I ran, I think in your promo for this show, how I ran in the Democratic primary, just as I did for the state Senate, working to hold hands with folks that I generally agree with on a lot of issues, but sometimes don't always agree with on how far it's gone or where sometimes the direction went. And asking the voters, do you want me to be the Democrat and the progressive who runs for lieutenant governor? And thankfully, they said yes. I think that was more pragmatic, frankly, than trying to just run as a progressive, create a three-way race. And so going to California, we'll be talking about some of those kinds of things.
I want to bring us back to state politics, but still in this arena of politics and how politics work. When Phil Scott was lieutenant governor, he was in Peter Shumlin's cabinet. Peter Shumlin made a big announcement about this, basically. You know, we're going to have Phil Scott in. It's a team of rivals, but also, you know, he's part of the government. Let's have him in here. Phil Scott tells us that that actually wasn't much of a benefit. Let's hear what he says.
I wasn't an active member of the cabinet. I was invited to come to cabinet meetings, which didn't amount to much, and I eventually stopped going because you didn't really have much of a voice. It's part of his team, and I respected that. It's what you what you want to build. And so I didn't make a lot of noise about it. I just went along and did my my duties, and I was able to accomplish a lot of things as lieutenant governor just by utilizing my network and going out on the road and meeting people and trying to have an effect on legislative action. And I thought it worked out pretty well for me.
Now, Phil Scott has not made you a part of his cabinet, and perhaps some of the reasoning is in there in his thinking about what was effective or not effective in being part of the previous governor's cabinet. David Zuckerman, what would you like? You're not part of the cabinet. Would you like to be? Would you like to have more input into what the governor is doing and saying?
Well, I think it's important to recognize he was elected governor and I was elected lieutenant governor. So it is his administration. And so with respect to input, certainly if he wants my information about something that I might know more about, you know, he knows he can call me and we have a good relationship. We've got each other's direct numbers and so forth.
But you don't march into his office and say, hey, Phil, here's what you got to do.
No, I don't think that's would be the appropriate thing to do. But where I am slightly different than Governor Scott with respect to the role of lieutenant governor, I think one can go around the state, use one's networks, help citizens get through the bureaucracy of government, do the various things that you do as lieutenant governor. But one can also attend those cabinet meetings, and not so much to give input, but to actually make sure you have your finger on the pulse of what the different agencies are doing and what's going on. And I also recognize, certainly if they're having political discussions and strategy, and the governor and I don't always agree, that you know, certain meetings, and then that maybe not where it's appropriate for me to be, because you don't show your cards to someone who disagrees with you on everything before you lay it out for the public. But at the same time, you know, I think we have to recognize I'm one step away, hopefully not going to happen, but I am one heartbeat away from being the governor. And attending those meetings allows one to develop relationships with all the secretaries and the commissioners. And, you know, I can do that independently. And some of those were folks I've already known from the governor. Prior Governor Shumlin's administration, but I think we could do more together. But it's the governor's call, and I respect that. And so I'm doing that work independently and working with folks who are dealing with Act 46 with Secretary Holcomb and working with folks who are dealing with agriculture with Secretary Tebbets. And so it's relationships I already have, so I'm working them directly. And mostly I'm going around the state working with citizens, listening to what their issues are. I went to Newport and visited Revision, where they build the helmets and other military equipment, and also visited the prison and really got a better understanding of what those folks are doing. I went down to Middlebury for the Labor Day parade event and listened to and talked with folks there. I've been down to Rockingham to talk about economic development and what's going on with the bridges there and then the island and some of the issues. So I'm working to get around the state and hear what's going on, and I'll give my input to different agencies and government based on what people want me to do.
Well, speaking of constituents, let's see if we can get one more call in here from Rick in Johnson. Hi, Rick. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm calling in regard to gas prices, which went up 40 cents a gallon after the hurricane last week. We have another hurricane coming, and I also understand from a local source that we may be seeing $3.50 a gallon gas by the end of next week based on this forecast. And I'm wondering, with the heat season coming, if there's any political will in Montpelier to work on a law about gouging. This fuel that we're paying more for now was bought and paid for in March.
Rick, let's put that to the lieutenant governor. We're short on time, so I want to hear what David Zuckerman has in response.
Well, sure. We certainly have started to look at that in the past. I know Senator Sorotkin and then Rep. Now Senator Pearson have worked on that some with respect to Chittenden County and some of the pricing of fuel in Chittenden County relative to other counties and why was it more expensive. I think the caller has a very good point, and it's an issue that I think our economic development committees in the House and Senate ought to look into. You know, a lot of this is now at the federal level, and partly it's panic. I was listening to actually a VPR the other day with Tom Ashbrook, and someone called in and said, the lines at the gas stations are you know, running out of gas because everyone's panicking instead of just going about your normal business. So partly we need leadership that says, don't panic, don't everybody fill every 5-gallon jug you have, because that's what creates a depleted supply, and that's going to lead to price going up. But also, I think the caller is correct. Whether it's food, whether it's fuel, our basic needs should not be at the whim of the supply and demand, and in particular, price gouging scenario that does happen. And we can certainly look into that.
Well, David Zuckerman, thank you very much for talking with us today. Look forward to hearing more from you as your term progresses, and we'll be sure to stay in touch. Thanks very much.
Well, thank you. And if I could just mention, I have a newsletter people can get. If they go online to ltgov.vermont.gov, you can sign up. And during the session, we send it out every couple of weeks. Gives people an update on some of the issues that are happening and how to reach their representative or senator if they want to get more engaged. And that's really the silver lining of the Trump administration, is that people are picking up the phone. People are engaging in democracy more than just voting, and that's really important.
Lieutenant Governor David Zuckerman.